this is meant to be an entertainment. Entertaining afternoon. I would like, I hope that this will actually stay, but the idea is to have, I'm trying to refer to things that have been discussed through the time that we've been sitting here and yakking every morning and the other meetings. So I'm going to address various things that came out that I want to just put in a little emphasis or a little different twist on. And I'm going to, I called it two because it's kind of a continuation of what I was saying when we had the conference, and the title in fact was same as the original was going to say what I'm saying here, but I ended up talking about just more or less the first part. So I'm going to talk about three things, three parts that I want to emphasize. One is the idea of a vertical angular momentum transport by large magnetic fields. And that's the stuff that I talked about at the conference. So the idea is that I will present semi-elliptic models of jet launching protostellar disks as a case study, as an example. So the first part, which I hope will be about like 20 minutes at most, so please stop me if I cross the session because I don't want to talk about the other things, will be basically, to a large extent, a repetition of what I already said at the conference. And I'm doing that both because people have wanted me to talk more about it than I never got a chance, and also because when I was a student, if the professor didn't come and repeat it the next time around, it was never really absorbed. So I thought, might as well. So this is the first point. The second point is refers to something that we didn't discuss, and I presume was discussed mostly during the early part of the meeting when I wasn't here on the touristic part. And so I wanted to make a point. The main point here would be about hydromagnetic jet models for relativistic flows. And we've been talking quite a bit about pulsar type winds and a lot of interesting questions that have been raised. And there is a class of a school of thought that wants to discuss gamma burst flows or even galactic nuclear flows in terms of pulsar type electromagnetic winds. And I would like to make the point that purely hydromagnetic picture. I mean, the distinctions are obviously murky, and they got about the kinetic approach, so it's not like totally black and white, but that an MHD type model, you can take a very loaded jet at the base of a gamma ray burst source, and can turn it into a range factor of 1,000 or a few hundred at distances that you refer gamma ray burst device by purely MHD models, especially basic MHD. And by the way, the recent simulations that McKinney sent around were also like, they started with a point in flux, but they also loaded it, and eventually they also were referring to MHD models. The last point I want to address is magnetic energy dissipation, which is what John just mentioned. We have talked about, also earlier in the meeting, about magnetic energy dissipation, especially in pulsars. What happens if you have those zebra-type fields? Are they likely to occur also in organ jets, in gamma-burst, for example? Would you imagine advecting regions of different polarity, and then reconnecting them, and in pulsars, we ask, what will happen? Will they survive from the shock? Will they reconnect in the shock, before the shock, after the shock? I want to point out something completely different. There's a very natural magnetic energy dissipation having to do just with the fact that the B5 is growing. And the B5, again, things that came out in the meeting and came up in some simulations, but I want to point out that this basic idea of magnetic energy dissipation having to do nothing with injecting opposite polarities, but just naturally with the fact that B5 is growing and wants to kink. And here I'm going to revive a paper that is 20 years old. I'm going for my defense, I will use what Jim Parker once told me, that you just have to go and advertise your own work, otherwise nobody else would. So 20 years later, I'm trying to do that. But I think it's very relevant, and I wanted to bring this to people's attention. And the example would be four-sphere equilibrium of extragalactic radio. Okay. So, starting with the steady state models of magnetic disk wind models. The main point I want to drive in is that vertical angular momentum transport could be a critical component. It's not just here we have a wind, A humidity disk, it has viscous stresses, probably MRI, transports matter ready. Oh yes, and there's also wind, and we could probably speed it up or drive it. This would be like an afterthought. My point is that as important as, of course, radial viscous transport is and would likely be, the fact that we drive outwards may be an inherent component of the disk and how the disk transports are invented. And in the case of young stars, it is in fact the dominant mode of transport. So the idea is that you can have rotation supported disks threaded by open magnetic field lines. At least part of the angular momentum is removed from the accreted matter and transported vertically. Instead of and deposited in the outflow, or as I mentioned, I'll emphasize again today, it doesn't have to be an outflow. It could be any load outside, just the whole picture of the magnetic breaking. You connect, you send out fan waves, torsional fan waves, which just transport the magnetic wave when it's a load. And that was the old picture of how molecular cloud cores reduce the angular momentum in molecular clouds. And that could be quite relevant here as well, but outflows in particular. And then, in a steady state, you could imagine that this field is just kept there by, against radial attraction and azimuthal shearing by magnetic diffusivity. So here's an example that I already gave and drew the fascinating response of some people. This is again quoting from Wojtas article. But there's a recent development in the studies of young stars based on Hubble imaging that. And here is this one quotation, I'm not going to read it. But the main point is that we, from putting grids about protostellar disks on scales of fractions of, or being able to extrapolate fractions of a U or of order U, one estimates that the outflows that we see actually originate in this, not in any X wind or anything like that that has been proposed. Not in the star, in the disk. And that if you already, in conjunction with applying simple wind modes where you say it's going to go to your endpoint, that B5 will dominate, what is the relation between B5 here and what where it started, using such simple modes, one infers that the angular momentum transport rate of the jet can be a large fraction, this is based on the observations for this source, 2/3 or more of the estimated rate transported through the relevant portion of the disk. This is reading from the abstract of the paper and verifying that B5 over BP in fact dominates on larger distances where the observations are.
Now, Ray, did they set a lower limit to where the acceleration starts in radius on the disk?
They don't address that. Okay, oh, they just say if we use, say, constants of omega along the field line, that's where we would extrapolate.
But not so. But I don't want to spend time defending the X-wind model particularly, but as an example of something where the wind is propelled by the star rather than, or the interaction of the disk with the star rather than by the disk itself, they don't set a lower limit. How do they know that it didn't come from that close end?
Has to do more with what the actual angular momentum at the base would be, which is presumably relatively high, and also with extrapolating the flow lines of this.
So is the outflow velocity also then quite small because it's being launched from an AAU?
No,
how far off the disk is the outflow?
Well, they are looking at it on scales of tens of AU and extrapolating. Down, but they have the series of, as I've shown before, they have a series of slots, of slips that put along the jet in different directions, and
I guess I meant asymptotic velocities of order RA omega.
So here's what they do, they look slip by slip, they can dissolve the jet transversely, and they then get the information in terms of the transverse velocity gradient, the radial velocity, and the line of sight velocity, and the density is because of the more ionization structure. So I'm not prepared to answer it definitively, but you can, as you see, they do a very detailed, they actually resolve that, which is, this is the new development that they cannot do it and do it with the slip. And the references that I gave, essentially, the last I heard from Tom May, I forget, was somewhere between 10 to 20. Essentially, every object that is being studied now is showing that behavior. So it's not just some kind of free.
Say that again. Every object that is being studied
shows that there is a reasonable fraction of the angular that they infer is coming from the disk is ending up in the object.
And is it the case that it's all the angular momentum going out and all the mass going into the center? Is the mass going out with the angle?
Most of the mass goes into the center.
So you have a pure angular momentum when?
No, not pure.
And the angular and all the mass
going into the center. Surprise, surprise, m dot out is the order 0.1 m dot.
So the alpha n radius is a few times the logical.
A few times the logical. So m dot out is typically of order 0.1 m dot in, and similar behavior, remind you, was also read years ago for FU Ionis outputs. It's also where we have direct evidence that you have outputs for the disk. And similar numbers, and also,
That was from much farther in, I thought.
That was
the outflows come from much farther in the angular Ionis outburst when all the angular momentum is already gone.
We don't know.
How do they actually get an angular momentum that's in the outflow?
Simply from, not simply, but the way they did it was they measure transverse velocity.
Let's
say, could interpret as rotation.
Transverse velocity. They have a slit going
across the jet. Yeah, so
they're getting line of sight velocity.
Line of sight velocity is a function of distance from the jet axis.
So they see not only is the jet blue as it's coming toward me, but then on each side of the jet it's bluer or less blue.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
In fact, so here is they plot those gradients as a function of distance. So these papers are very, I would like to urge you to look at those papers. That's my main point, because obviously this would be a nice, fascinating topic to discuss in the morning. I put some references here for, so again, there are several sources, DGTAO, Leakage Alpha 321, this 28, but these are the best studies, except in addition to this RWO.
One of the points that the angular momentum per gram in JET, the radio, they're seeing at 10 AU or whatever, that's large compared to Keplerian angular momentum and what is thought to be the disk's inner edge.
Yeah. So they are tying it to the region from where it came.
Well, that's a strong argument against
the X-wing,
which
I think it's very strong.
That kind of model tend to have star and curve rotation.
That's exactly right.
Is this the jet proper, or is this the wide angle flow?
I think this is what we would call a jet, but I don't know. Because it's within, it's on scales of tens of the U, so it's not. So. I don't know what the wide angle flow would be. That's a jet.
In YSO, there's a very tiny culminating fast jet.
This would be what we would call the jet because it's visible. It's the inner region. It's the high resolution. So I think this is an important message and very valuable. It's a new stuff, but it's a system that we can actually see nearby relatively and measuring, and we are trying something very important. So here's some, again, so I discussed those, I'm not going to repeat all the details. You can, here is the model that Mark Roland and I, who was here and he talked at the conference, did 10 years ago. In this, we call it the fusion Hall regime. So this was the effect of diffusivity. The nice thing about these models is you can actually model the microphysics. You don't just have to assume anomalous resistivities. You really model it to the best of your ability. What's the ionization structure? What is the corresponding conductivity? What does it do to the field at any location? And Michael Sundron, who's now at Chicago, and Mark are now trying to further improve on those old models by really doing the ionization with X-rays and including MRI, as I already mentioned here and mentioned again. So here's a simple model of pure wind driving disk, meaning no radial angular momentum transport. Imagine all the angular momentum transport does go up in the wind. And do those same classifications, it's isothermal, geometric thing, Keplerian, and we match the local, we match the disk solution to a wind solution, and I already mentioned before the sun confusion when Han gave a lecture, he claimed that this was not done either. He was wrong about that. The effect of the outside field that determines how the field lights of the disk surface are arranged is included in the small. So it's effectively a global model, although simplified because we are tying it to a self-similar wind model. And people like Xiong Li and Ferreira, particularly Xiong Li, took the same kind of models and built a global disk wind model, again, self-similar disk wind model, which includes this effective diffusivity in this, and so inflow. And so these are those typical kind of, so here's the magnetic field lines, and here are those flow lines coming in and peeling out, flow lines coming in.
So the disk in these things is larger radially than the Alphane, from the height of the Alphane surface?
Yeah, so this is very simplified model. It's all self-similar model. Uh-huh. So they just...
it's all similar. This goes on forever. But.
Yeah, forever. So, and the Alphane surface is just... This is the Alphane surface, this is the crust.
Right. So the presumption is that everywhere where you're focusing is important, but the disk was bigger, was larger in radius than that at that height.
Effectively so. Or something else came to...
Sure, they could put a wall, or could put a pipe around it, too.
Or the interstellar medium.
Well, the interstellar medium is far away compared to these things.
Yeah, no, but on these scales, yeah, the most of the action is still... there is something that is supported.
What's the value of beta in the disk? So in the disk midpoint?
No, it's different. When people say color magnetic diagram, I go blank. When they say beta, I go blank. But thermal to magnetic stress. So in this... these are the well-coupled disk models, so typically beta is a 4-to-1 in the magnetic plane, meaning that the field is not much, it's still thermally dominated, but not highly dominated. I'll show you models that where it's not the case, but the magnetic field is much weaker, but it's still pretty much.
We want to know when 20 minutes pass, by the way.
Okay, so I mean, therefore, so let me actually do just this diagram here and skip much of the rest. This is really, again, from this original paper, this is the physics of it, kind of cartoon of the physics, but there are three regions, and as I announced in one of those morning sessions, I realized people now talk about coronas and days of winds. This is exactly what we talked about then in terms of different terminology. So here's the base of the region where the magnetic field is subservient to the matter. Pressure dominates. It's quasi-hydrostatic. There's already a little bit of a VZ, but very little, so it doesn't affect the dynamics. And we can treat it, and in fact, derive various constraints, algebraic constraints, just by assuming that it's quasi-hydrostatic. And so what, so remember, so this is in the anapolar diffusion regime, so the ions and electrons go together. The ions, so the field line in the steady state model is just sitting here. The ions are sitting, are not going anywhere. But the neutrals stream through them. So as they stream through, so the neutrals lose angular momentum to the field, therefore they go in. As they go in, they push along on the field line. The field line wants to stay in place, has to bend back, because the magnetic tension will be balancing the drag pressure on the ions. So it bends back. And this is a wonderful feature. So it naturally bends back, so that eventually it will bend enough that it can drive the wind.
This is dominated by anapolar diffusion?
In this case, yes.
Because usually that occurs at much lower densities compared to the other, because of the Hall currents.
Well, so this,
this is far out,
this is 180.
Okay. Yeah, well, I didn't realize you were so
this
far.
Okay. This particular one was 400.
Okay.
And then, so as it starts going up and the density drops, the field becomes dominating. It's a transition region. That's what now we call the corona in some of those numerical simulations. But this is a transition region, still an inflow, but the field is no longer being strongly bent, becomes more or less straight. And then at some point, there's a transition between the field being bent in this way to the field trying to straighten itself back up as it would do in the wind. The same point more or less happens when the field, instead of taking angular momentum from the matter, starts giving back angular momentum to the matter. Therefore, the iron V phi becomes larger than the neutrals, whereas in the midplane it was the opposite direction. It was VI phi was less than V phi. So basically, the ions lagged the neutrals, and therefore the motion here was sub-Keplerian. And what happens that at exactly the surface where the magnetic stress essentially vanishes, the motion is Keplerian. So it is actually Keplerian here. It's sub-Keplerian here. And it's sub-Keplerian because there is this additional magnetic stress that opposes gravity, having to do with the bending of the field. That's the analog of Avramovich's slim disk mass, except that here the magnetic field plays the role of the thermal, of the hot thermal pressure.
How sub is sub-Keplerian?
Not hugely. It's still to linear order.
To linear order, it's very, very close, right?
It's so this is very close. Okay. It's close. And from here on, this matches then to the base of the end. You see, there's a, such as a model that self-consistently takes away the angular momentum, bends the field, gives this angular momentum back as it drives the field. So this is not new stuff, but one point that I wanted to mention that came up in discussion when you actually look at those the solution, in this previous solution, you notice that this W here is the normalized velocity over the speed of sound. You notice, so here is the R component. So you see there is a profile in the disk. This is calculated at each height. It's not, it's a deep, so you know, it first increases, then decreases, then becomes Keplerian. But I'm sorry, so this is the V5, but here is now VR. And notice that this is normalized by the speed of sound. So these models tend to give you possibly a quite likely, I mean, quite naturally, inflow speeds that are could be comparable of the order of speed of sound, a little less, a little more, but not hugely less. And that point came when we discussed the idea of how AGN disk can become self-gravitating, and this was a point that Jeremy Goodman made. You notice that indeed if you can, there was some confusion in this paper which we discussed, but he did notice that indeed if you have the models where VR can be avoided C sub S, of course the densities would be much less, and therefore you would push the distance where self-gravity would become important further up, and so that helps in that respect. Okay, so let me, so the one thing that I mentioned is that this work is now being done with the sound element, and I talked about stability of those configurations in my previous presentation, so let me not dwell on it now. But what we are doing now is we are taking detailed models of the ionization, verticalization, and conductivity structure of those disks, and then repeating that same calculation for and trying to see if we can fit both radial, if we can satisfy the MRI condition in regions where the MRI is satisfied, but the wind launching is not self-consistent. This would be the region of MRI dominance. As we go further up, it would be the wind dominance. So we can imagine a layer disk which in principle could do both, could have some regions which, this is a simplified way of thinking of it, and probably in the future we will be more sophisticated and we could see how maybe couple the radial to the vertical waves in some more natural ways. But right now we're just like trying to isolate regions which would be naturally susceptible to MRI in the disk, in certain regions of the disk, and other regions further up which would be driving the wind and not doing mostly vertical transport, and seeing how I can resist showing the simulations that I got from Ryochi on his work with Corbara. So again, they have resisted these models like Kassel and Kepler that I showed before, where they kind of converge to a steady state where the angular momentum goes up along the flow. So I know that without showing the simulation, very little, we believe. And even the final point that I also made, this is in response to what he was asking, you can have malls which are weakly coupled, in which case most of, right near the midplane, it's really the magnetic field is much weaker than thermal pressure, and you have to wait until you start coupling. So first B5 starts going, as we discussed, basically because you drive a current. And you already have BB5DZ, and therefore you have angular momentum transport, even though you never, the field didn't start bending, and therefore you could start, imagine driving a wing or an MRI until much further up, another, maybe a couple of scale heights. So, in principle, so my point is that in principle, angular momentum could be removed even from weakly coupled widgets, where BR is relatively weakened. And MI will not operate because of this torque. And that's a point that we also noticed in Morland, and we will try to incorporate it into those models that we are not really showing on carefully. Okay, so let me switch. Right, so the rest of this story was, and I can tell you more maybe on other occasions, but the rest of this story was in my original talk, sorry for the beginning. Let me switch to the other topic and just again, just highlight one. So I'm switching now to jets. So here's this driving jets. Now let's look at the jets. We know that, again, just in overall scope, the jets are accelerating to highly supersonic and superatomic speeds. And you can think of it that very close to the base, the jets are accelerated by thermal and centrifugal stresses. And certainly in the case of the Newtonian kind of jets that we usually talk about, this is mostly where the story is. But nevertheless, further out, and possibly even from the beginning, close in, but further out, the gradient in B5 squared of A5 would take over. And then in the case of relativistic acceleration, this is the dominant force. This is what will take it from gamma out. This is, if you need to get to gamma of 1,000, most of the work will be done by this gradient of B5 squared of A5. And without going into terminology of what modified fast magnetosonic substance versus regular, Bogovalov was here and he talked to some of us about it, and I'm just making the statement here that in principle you could continue accelerating very far in such MHD models, well beyond the classical fast mode. And this extended acceleration is a signature, distinguishing signature versus purely hydrodynamic models of such MHD jets. And I'll come back to it in a minute because I think we have evidence of such extended acceleration already in active here. So this is a distinguishing characteristic. You will accelerate on scales which are orders of magnitude larger than gravitational nozzle from where you started. So it's not like thermal Parker wind that you just ran through the nozzle and that's it, on scales of the gravitational waves. It will collimate as well. The collimation is a little tricky because when you are relativistic, it's harder to collimate. So you'd like to do most of the collimation early on, but the acceleration will be
definitely. So you take a system like M87 and you have those images where it looks like it's collimating at 100 RG. So you would argue it could be collimating at 100 RG and then accelerating much further out.
Yes, I would say that most of the collimate, that it should collimate relatively fast, but the acceleration could continue. I mean, these things are not separate from each other. I mean, they are.
Right.
And again, we had some discussion here on Bogovalov and Komisar, where we talked about it in some length. And again, this is where Larakis worked and wrote some review articles on the ideas that in order to accelerate, you need to have the distance between the neighboring Bogovalov field lines grow. So it's a little counterintuitive. You have to somehow separate the field lines in order to have the B5 increased. On the other hand, you also want to collimate. But that's what those solutions achieve. It doesn't happen uniformly in space. So therefore, you kind of collimate, but then still continue to. As you collimate, you still have a bit of a separation of the field lines so that they can accelerate. So the, you probably, so I won't go through all this law about gamma bursts, which few hundreds and angles, unifair jets of open angles of 15 degrees and reaching hundreds, noise factors of hundreds to a thousand. We believe that magnetic fields are the plausible means of accelerating them, but thermal energy is probably important from every base, from neutrino emission and possibly also magnetic field reconnection. So, therefore, we would like to study modes where both effects are taken into account, thermal and magnetic. There's also evidence for hydroelectric flows in AGNs, and there were some people who talked to you about AGNs and said, oh, you know, we have to account for 2 to 5, 2 to 10. That's not really the case. We are now seeing evidence just from apparent speeds that are as high as 40 C. And this would be just the lower limit on the actual Lorentz factor. So I would venture that more likely the Lorentz factors are in the range of 10 to 100. So we really have to be, so a viable model should be able to account for those numbers, not just for 2 to 3. Okay, I mean, there's also evidence from X-ray features in several QSOs that there's some minor relativistic motions of the air, so that's more likely, possibly also magnetic, but not necessarily hyperlegistic. Okay, so I don't want to discuss it in too much detail, just to say that we took models that are, this is now where the entire Zagreb and I did in the last few years and continue to do. You could just take models which are either dominated by the colloidal field, or as we discussed, kind of like this mechanism that we talked about this morning, you have winding up of these bisects will be D phi dominated, maybe in some episodic type of reconnection. And so initially, D5 would only be polar. But whichever way it is, you can then imagine that you are now in the MHD limit and you are trying to build a solution. And so subject to those various, so basically we have solution of the relativistic ideal energy formulation, kind of the generalization of the Langford chain, but this time to the relativistic case and including thermal stresses. And I should point out that you would wonder, well, here we have those gamma bursts, why can we apply steady state models to them? And if you have very high, in the limit that the Lorentz factor, colloidal Lorentz factor is very high, you can imagine the whole thing is being a frozen pulse, so that even though you are following a given shell, it passes different stations along the way which are described by the steady state model, and this description is adequate. It was shown before to be adequate for the hydrodynamic modeling, and we showed it in the case that the colloidal field remains more or less constant on the scale of the burst. That's also a good approximation for the MHD. So the steady state models are adequate for this model. And so we have, this is not a simple problem. We have seven constraints for which have to do with boundary conditions, and 3 determined by passing the relevant critical points. But nevertheless, one can get a solution. And this is done through this separation of radial separation variables by assuming power laws along radial rays. And we further separate solutions to be either in this regime, which is the relative to the relativistic case in particular, which is the current carrying regime, where J parallel is anti-parallel to bipolar, J polar is anti-parallel to bipolar, and here the return current, and even made some little Pullman's current closure, and we knew nothing to eliminate by matching solutions starting from here to solution from here, so it's as if we represent the current kind of closed solution. But of course, this is just a very, very good approximation to show that those things are not falling.
possible.
So I'm really impressing you that this is not a trivial problem, that's mostly. So the details are in those papers. But what is interesting is at the end of the day, when you get solutions, and I'm just again showing just one solution as an example, you find out, so here's a gamma-based type solution. And what is plotted here is the pointing flux, here is the amplitude flux, and here is the Lorentz factor. And here are the classical points, and here is the... So here are the classical points along the new, of if you just solve the new equation, with a fixed shape of the flux tubes, this would be the relevant singular points, but really you have to solve also the transfer equation, and so the event horizon for the magnetosonic waves is not the classical class, but it's further out, much further out. So what happens is the field starts guiding the flow from the beginning, but initially the acceleration is really done. It's like the standard quote-unquote fireball that people talk about for so that now it's confined by the magnetic field and the scaling up to being the radius of that cylinder rather than the spherical length. And so initially the acceleration is thermal. Eventually, and so you see the Lorentz factor keeps increasing, eventually it ramps out of thermal boom, and then the pointing flux, which is the gradient of d5, takes over as the dominant acceleration. And you see maybe here you manage even to accelerate in this solution, which is one ideal solution, so you get to very high few thousands here. But so on that scale, a tenth of the acceleration was very down thermally or so. But then the pointing flux starts decreasing, and you are accelerating. And we have solutions that give a few 200 or so, which are more the lower values, lower limits that we are now accepted for gamma bursts in that order. In any case, the main point is at the end, we have more or less an equipartition. About half of this initial pointing flux was transferred into kinetic energy. So it's a very efficient accelerator. And we can take sometimes it's 75% or so. So we can transform over, depending whether we start with colloidal dominated, d5 dominated, eventually we transform more than 50% of the magnetic energy to kinetic energy, which has the right, which was tailored to give the right parameters for gamma waves. So it's stepping 51x, and the Lorentz factors are in hundreds of thousands of variants. So it's a baryonic type of thing. Yeah, so I think that's important to realize. You can get such very high Lorentz factors with a loaded flow, where you start with sigma very, very much larger than 1, the magnetization, and end up sigma over 1. There's a whole body of work that I'm not going to discuss on how you can take neutron-rich flows and possibly account for the baryon loading problem in gamma bursts. Just for the lack of time, there's a couple of papers with Lakis and Tang, and most recently with Granot and Tang, and I wrote on this topic. So I'm inviting you to look at that. I just want to mention this. So I had some discussions with Amir when he was here. Levinson and I have produced, and more recently, similar to Greg McKinney. So imagine that you just start with essentially baryon, only the type of baryon flow near the axis here, the type of rotational energy of the black hole, and then load it by neutrons from the side, the pickup neutrons, which just then go collide inside this flow and turn into protons and become the flow that we see. So that's one picture. We are proposing an alternative picture where you start with neutron-rich flows from the disks themselves, with surrounding disks. The same kind of flows that I was showing you the solutions for, although those solutions apply as well to what these people are doing, because they really describe the last scale acceleration. But you could imagine that you start also if you can, so it's not clear whether the other picture is viable, whether you can really take reasonably less, not such a huge M dot from the disk, but if you could, you could imagine starting with a neutron-rich flow and then having the neutrons decouple and the protons continue to accelerate and create the jets, the gamma jets that we see. The neutrons, because they don't collimate, will go off to the side, will create a second component, wider jet component, that will then, after the neutrons decouple, will dominate the late afterglow of the jets. So there's a very clear prediction of two component afterglow jet, for which there has been some evidence, but this evidence is controversial. And so this recent work that Hanging Granoff and I did was trying to kind of solidify those observational predictions so these things can be tested. Okay, so let me, I should also mention that the there's a very strong evidence in active galactic nuclei for, that's the one point that I could still make before we went to the last topic, is in active galactic nuclei there's a growing, there's also strong evidence for the acceleration occurs on large scales. The recent arguments from Bohr quantization signatures or lack thereof that the Lorentz factors of that order must be attained on scales which are relatively large. You see, much larger than what you start with the event horizon of the black hole. And there have been some less precise, but nevertheless, combining apparent superluminal motion with arguments, quantization arguments, to try to pin down. They're usually, there are always two variables, the angle and the Lorentz factor, and you need two constraints to pin them down. Apparent superluminal motion is one of them, but you need something else, and that's the difficult. If you can argue that you have something like an inverse Compton catastrophe argument that gives you some estimate of the Doppler factor, you can get another constraint. For this kind of constraints, for two quasars, there have been arguments that there is direct evidence for some blobs accelerating from gamma of 5 to gamma over 10 on scales of parsecs in one case, and gamma, again, on gammas of a few to gamma of 10s of gamma of 8 to 13 on scales again of tens of parsecs. So these are, and if you just look at the histogram of apparent superluminal motions in jets, and of course this is just looking at the front parameter, but even so, there's usually a trend that as you move further from the source, the knots, the projected knots, have higher apparent speed. Of course, there can be projection effects that can skew it, but to me, it seems just the fact that we take more and more sources and the trend is always to have higher velocities as you move out, it must be telling you something. And as I mentioned, there are several cases where it's claimed that you can actually separate the two, the angle and the Lorentz factor, and claim directly that you see acceleration. So, again, we were able to take. So again, the argument is that there's no way, some people in the literature suggest, that this could be hydrodynamic acceleration. It has to be MHD, and in fact, is again, to me, we argue, a signature of this extended MHD acceleration. You can accelerate on scales of parsecs, so 0.1 sub-parsec to parsec scale. And so here is a particular, we use the same type of model for gamma that we had for gamma address with modified parameters to show that, again, how we can mimic that particular component in the squares of 3C345. Okay. So this was the second topic, and now I want to talk about magnetic energy dissipation. And in this last simulation paper by McKinney, there was argument also that it said as you move out, V5 starts dominating and the Kimball instability starts forcing the fields to readjust and reconnect. I think the physically, this is really the basis of what large-scale jets would do, not the zebra type of domain. Maybe there could be, you could imagine throwing opposite polarities of V5 S impulses that could then reconnect, but to me, this is much more natural and expected effect. So what I'm going to suggest is that even more generally, as you move, you suppose you accelerated the check. It's now moving supersonically, superatomically, but in its own frame, it's magnetically dominated because the under the B would be dominated by B5, and scalars, the transverse radius one of the R. But the thermal pressure typically would drop up of faster. So if you went far enough, the jet would internally be magnetically dominated, just its internal stresses. So imagine you're still moving along, highly supersonically. So the whole engine is dominated by the kinetic energy of this whole flow. But if you sit in the frame of the jet is thermally, is magnetically dominated locally. So the field can rearrange itself locally. And the argument is that it would then become force-free, meaning that magnetic tension rebalances the magnetic pressure gradients, and this is the general expression, curl B versus mu B. Mu B in general can be a function, just a function of the coordinates, but the argument based on Sperlmann experiment, reverse spin pinch experiment, confinement experiments is all, this is 30 years ago, this is the famous Taylor states 30 years ago, is arguing that if you have that under if you have a defined kind of plasma, it would go into a minimum energy linear force field, meaning that mu it was constant. And I worked on it, I'm embarrassed to say, 20 years ago. I was in that talk with Arnab Chaturi, where we really looked at very carefully at the implications of the distracted galactic nuclei in terms of various features in NGC 6251, which, by the way, now shows evidence for relativistic motions in its inner region, which are again probably magnetically driven. And so the one thing that I wanted to, so I will just tell you those, what this basic idea is and just relate it to the idea of dissipation. So the idea is, it's the following. So the idea is that, it's the key idea is here. If the jet possesses a magnetic energy dissipation mechanism, so it doesn't have to be completely, so it's still ideal MHD in the sense that the large scale field, the dynamics is ideal MHD, but it doesn't have to conserve its energy. It can, if it can dissipate energy, it can dissipate energy so it can reach a minimum energy state. And now, what is the minimum energy state? I mean, there must be some constraint. It's a kind of a variational principle. And the variational principle, the Taylor idea was that, that basically we are minimizing the energy subject to the constraints that the magnetic helicity is concerned. Magnetic helicity is the measure of the knottedness, the linkage of the flux tubes. That is, and you can argue in terms of the turbulence, where helicity cascades to larger scales, in MHD, energy to lower scales, where it's dissipated, but, and that's what Taylor did, and other people had this discussion in terms of turbulence, but observationally we actually see it. We see it in experiment reverse, so-called reverse field, reverse pinch.
Reverse field pinch.
Reverse field, the pinch experiment. That the field, in fact, settles into just amazing thing, there are only two modes. So if you have the, and we argue that if you have a pressure-confined superatomic jet, which is supersonic to the ambient gas, effectively its supersonic motion prevents buckling the walls, because if you buckle more, if you protrude more than the run of the marker angle, it will just cut you through, so it's essentially rigid. So we said it more or less approximates a rigid cylinder locally, and therefore we can take over those simple solutions which are valid for a local rigid cylinder.
Why are you now invoking pressure confinement?
Just because I need, something has to always confine the jet. So the pressure, I would like to use the confining pressure as a parameter, which will tell me the radius of the jet, basically. So there are only two modes. And so let me just show you, and you can calculate the helicity. In fact, now that we will be able to look at better at the inner jets, we will be able to put some constraints on the helicity injection, but here's the helicity injection in terms of where it comes from. in the disk. So you, and we had this when Eric Blackmon was here. He likes to talk about velocity of ideas, those ideas also possibly velocity in larger scales, maybe creating large scales in disk dynamos. I think it's all very promising. But the basic idea that you have magnetic velocity being concerned, and that if you have a disk, and or actually Steve here also talks about in similar terms, when we have when we drive the jet from a rotating disk, we basically are injecting velocity. So here are the two modes. It's really miraculous. There are only two modes. There's an axisymmetric mode, which is basically a vessel, just VZ and VFI. And the VZ reverses to zero at some radius and then changes polarity, changes sign. And then there's an axisymmetric mode, which has a wavelength of roughly 5 times the rate. Radius, which becomes dominant at some particular pressure, and it's like two oppositely directed flux tubes that are intertwined around each other on a scale of about 5 times the jet radius. So it's a periodic, so this is the cross section. See, so it's radial VR along the mid plane here, and this direction kind of rotates around. So So if you now use the pressure as a...
So isn't that a straight jet?
Sorry?
Isn't that a straight magnetic field jet?
It's...
intertwining oppositely directed fields.
They are intertwined along the axis.
Right.
Yeah.
So they go around, they braid.
They braid, yes. So if you look at the function of, for example, the... So if I use the pressure as normal, so here's the psi is the axial flux, which is conserved, this is the elasticity of the length. And you can see that if you move from regions of large pressure, initially only the, and so this can all be done analytically, that's the beauty of it. If you move from regions of high pressure, at very high pressure near the source, only the m equals zero. Purely axisymmetric mode domain. At some point, the energy m equals 1 becomes energetically favorable, and then it's kind of, you can make analogies with rotating fluid bodies, and we did it in the paper again, how the bifurcation from Jacobi ellipsoids to, I forget the exactly which ones that they were, but it's a very similar kind of, and you can make a direct analogy. Here, so beyond that, the n equals zero, of course, still has to be there because the flux is still, the net flux is carried by this n equals zero, it has to remain conserved. But more and more n equals one comes in as you move to lower and lower pressure. And that means that more and more of the non-axisymmetric component comes in. And so we have done extensive, that came just after NBC-1, which observed very carefully by Perry and collaborators, and they showed all kinds of funny wiggles and correlations between the polarization and the rotation measure, changing directions around and from one side of the jet to the other side of the jet on quasi-periodic scale. And I actually have those diagrams here, and if somebody wants to ask me later, I can show that. But we were able to basically model all these very nicely. And then we also applied it to polarization position angle swings in the VLAC object. All this, and the beauty of it is that the argument was there's nothing is moving. The jet isn't going anywhere because scales of 5 times the jet radius are very hard to excite so far away from the nozzle. I mean, it's not a dark scale Kelvin handle. It's a tiny few times the jet radius scales. And we said this is all kind of illusion because you're looking synchrotron emission, which only picks up the B pair component. And so if you see this non-axisymmetric moving around, you will be picking up, you will create effective knots, which will be moving from side to side, the polarization will be exactly anti-correlated with the disk. All those things just fall off directly, and we showed it. So it was a detailed paper on all those things. And I think it was very nice. The observers still remember it and quote it, but not much. such a green case has not been observed since then, but every now and then some jet shows some of these behaviors, which I think would be relevant. So maybe the last point that I wanted to make is on the magnetic energy dissipation, which is really... So that's why I use transparencies, because I recovered 20-year-old transparencies, which are the highest tech of the day. My handwriting has not improved since then. The point is, so this is similar ideas, were applied by Browning and Priest, and Priest and Evans around the same time for trying to explain the solar coronal heating, again by injecting magnetic electricity and this thing, and reaching this kind of Taylor state. So some of those arguments. So the idea is, imagine this, the jet is expanding. It wants, and so it now has a lower minimum energy state available to it. So it wants to reach this new minimum energy state. If it adjusts instantaneously, it dissipated more energy. And there's a formal proof based on Berger and Brownian, which you can show. So basically, physically, you have to build a little stress. There has to be some lag. There has to be a finite reconnection time. So you stress the field, and you have to wait a little time before you, if you instantaneously reconnect, you never really stressed it enough, and you didn't dissipate any energy. So there has to be some finite, although possibly less than one. So this ratio, which is left in all this algebraic work, the expanded Taylor Bessel functions to six order before we got the net concession. This is is maxima. This is the pre-mathematical bit. So the, oh, I did it by hand actually.
You were young then.
Sorry?
You were young then.
I was young then, that's right. Then,
so I used with the pre-maximum.
Then. Shapuri got the null result, and then maxima gave it the rest. But at the end, you are still left with this one particle where the physics is hidden, and we don't know it, and probably we still don't know. It's the time, the reconnection over the expansion time. So you can show that if there is a, so you can calculate, so this is, it's kind of like a Carnot cycle, and some people use the effective, like the, what is this, the, when you do turbulence, you say the, what is the term for that that you have,
many terms available.
Many terms, all kinds of
give us a hand.
Something to do with history.
There's some mnemonic for this kind of procedure, but it's like the, you have this mixing length. So here they talk about mixing time. Don't ask me why. Mixing time approximation. So you can imagine either to start contraction or expansion. So you start with some initial states. You imagine you contract. So imagine you contract over the expansion or contraction time under ideal NHD conditions. And then you allow yourself to relax to the Taylor state. So you contract to the new volume, but you now have higher pressure than the minimum energy state would be. And you then dissipate this energy to reach this minimum energy state subject, this Taylor state subject to conservation of magnetic electricity, and you can reach this point. And so this, it's like a Carnot cycle, this would give you the energy that was dissipated. In a real situation, probably it would be somewhere between. But we took this kind of calculated this energy in this area to get us the dissipation rate. At the end of the day, so that's where the Bessel functions came in the law. And here's this fantastic six order mu r kind of.
Thought Carnot cycles were reversible. But your energy dissipation is also reversible?
Not here.
It's not quite
the same.
When you reverse.
You use this energy.
The reversible Carnot cycle.
It's not called a Carnot cycle, but it's a Carnot cycle.
Let's stand for the Carnot cycle then. But the main point is that you see there is this parameter here that actually tells you what, that will tell you how much energy you will dissipate, and that is not clear. And because if you go both in the sun and the jets, the, so it's, for example, the point where m equals 1 becomes, this point that m equals 1 kicks in is where, if you do a Turing mode, resistive Turing mode stability analysis for the jet, that's where resistive Turing mode kicks in. So you could imagine that those, that location where you can identify the points where you can say here is where Turing mode can take place, and maybe that's where the dissipation occurs. Nevertheless, how do you estimate the time? So the usual square root of faint time and resistive time is still much too long. So this epsilon would be too large. But we have about the magic 10 of n crossing times. And so it's an unknown. I don't know. If it is something like 10 of n crossing time, then we will get reasonable numbers. So if the main point was that we found that if epsilon, this ratio is of order unity, then when we look at those particular jets that we model with these parameters, we can account for the synchrotron radiation that we see. So synchrotron emission is a small fraction of the total energy, maybe a thousandth or so, but nevertheless, with this simple picture, you could say, in principle, you could say that what you see in synchrotron emission is, and this is continuously relaxing to minimum energy state, this is what's powering, or at least a good fraction of the synchrotron emission. So here's a mechanism for, you know, so we talked about gamma bursts now and this and that. Here's a mechanism for continuously adjusting as the jet propagates out, giving you a continuous dissipation of energy. That's basically the B5 turns into B for long.
Sorry, Ari, you were saying originally you can't continuously readjust because then you don't get any release of energy. Now, in the sun, that's usually because you don't do any work if you're continuously readjusting. You need to not be readjusting, you need to wind up the field and get the tension of the field
doing work against it.
Right, and then suddenly you turn on your dissipation, you release that energy, you put it into winding up the field. And so, so when you say continuously readjusting, you mean periodic readjusting?
No, sorry, my terminology was continuously, meaning as you move out along the jet. So you're moving out along the jet, which means you're moving out in this diagram that I showed, you're moving out to regions of, continuously into regions of lower pressure. So you move to regions continuously lower pressure, and therefore the radius of the jet continuously becomes wider and wider. And if you are still in the n equals 0 mode, this mu r, so for example, keeps growing and then it gets fixed, but if I now show the energy per unit length, so here is, I'm moving into regions of lower and lower pressure, the energy keeps dropping. So when I say readjust, it's like continuously move, the jet continues to expand. As I move along the jet, I move gradually but continuously into regions of lower pressure, and as the jet moves to further and further out, at each such location, it wants to achieve a new minimum energy state and will therefore continuously dissipate. But the idea is that as it does it, it shouldn't instantaneously relax. There should be a bit of a strain and then release, strain and release. But there's a continuous driving by the fact that the jet is continuously moving to regions where it can attain a lower and lower minimum energy state.
And it's achieving this minimum energy state by unwinding, destroying some of the field.
I didn't go into it, but what's really happening is changes completely the field topology, and Huey Lee was here, he was modeling radio loads and was very concerned about over predicting the realistic. This is the solution for that. Because what ends up, you are no longer having the d phi being much larger than d polloi. And d phi going as 1 over r and d polloi going as 1 over r squared. What you end up is having d phi being of order d polloi, because continuously d phi turns into d polloi. And basically the scaling now becomes something like half of the minus 3 halves, basically, some intermediate scale. So the net flux is still conserved. So you don't create any new net flux, but you are creating a lot of field at the expense. It's this king trying to explain itself, that, which is what people see in the simulations, but this is something that can be with you all the way. You don't have to have some drastic king instability, do terrible things to the jet. It can be a continuous readjustment, always reaching a minimum end.
And you're thinking of some kind of internal set of modes. I mean, this is like the RFP, reversed field.
This is a Taylor mode.
And to get back to this minimum energy state, you have to have some kind of turbulent relaxation each time.
These are the terms that people apply exactly when they talk about this. So they talk about turbulent MHD,
Well, when you see it in the lab, in order to get to this state, you always see a turbulent relaxation.
And in those terms, it's also, to my mind, reasonable to then talk about cascades of helicity and energy when you use the turbulent picture. So I just wanted to point this out, because I think this may well be relevant to all kinds of jets. Okay, so the conclusions. So I kind of touched on various things, and I apologize for kind of jumping from topic to topic, but the main points that I wanted to leave you with are the following. Again, with vertical angular momentum transport involving outposts or alpine waves launched along open magnetic field lines, that spread the disk is very likely informed, very important in polar stellar systems, and principle could be relevant also to other disk jet sources. Now, we have and continue to build semi-analytic and numerical models, and as I showed you, there are also numerical models that verify that you can have diffusive Christian disks that reach steady and likely stable. I didn't talk today about the stability that I talked about in the conference with Dylan. In those equilibrium states, where a large fraction in principle of the momentum could be transported vertically to magnetic equilibrium outflows. And in general, as I mentioned, probably there's a combination of radial MRI induced and vertical transport, which we are still attempting to model. It's work in progress. And I've been consulting with you on how best to do it. Now, such magnetic energy configurations, I didn't have time to repeat it today, but they are very naturally occurring in models of protostellar disk formation, because you form them from the collapse of magnetically supported molecular crowd cores, which are observed from polarization measurements as being threaded by large-scale field. So it's, and so these models that, again, on which there was some very nice semi-analytic, similar this time in R&T models that Ruben Kosmopolsky did, that he did, and I was on the paper, show that you can really create such disks and leave the field behind in an unfold diffusion shock and then encounter a centrifugal shock and create inner disk around this guy. And so there's and the reason you can do it is because when you turn in the center of gravity, the unfold diffusion starts becoming important again. Even though initially we started collapse, the field was just dragged in when it was set gravitating. The dependence of density and radius changes when you enter the regime of free fall in a central mass, and then antipolar diffusion time becomes shorter or comparable to the free fall time, and therefore antipolar diffusion can become important again and the field becomes, which was a discovery 3 years ago that wasn't anticipated. And then, so again, you actually can decouple the field and leave it behind in the disk as the matter goes in, using antipolar diffusion. And so one can imagine many ways of creating open field lines and not necessarily abducting them from large distances, although abducting them could be one way also in other sources. And when Jeremy was here, he was speculating on similar pictures that you may abduct cascade the impact. Kind of like, you know, on the lab, exempted from some streamers, from some molecular class or what have you. But I want to leave it general. It can be, there are different ways, but it may not be, but having open field lines is, may not be just a situation we see in young stuff. Then I talked about how, again, using exact semiotic solutions that you could, which are necessary. None of those simulations that we are seeing now are anywhere near covering this extended acceleration region. And so they, even when McKinney talks about gamma infinity being 1,000, he doesn't actually model it. He says this has the potential of being gamma. So therefore, we still have to rely on these kind of solutions, and we show that these kind of solutions, indeed, over large scales, we can achieve highly, at least the uncollimated, because the collimations in these solutions are either cylindrical or conical. So they are very well collimated. And the last point is that we find the last curve. So again, I want to emphasize that this extended acceleration region is a distinguishing characteristic. And so we don't see it in gamma bursts, obviously, but in active galactic nuclei, we can follow knots. And there is evidence that they're accelerating, in fact, so as I mentioned. So we are now trying to model, you know, we are now in a position of trying to really test this, because we have models that can give you the field structure, calculate the Doppler factor, calculate the polarization, functions of positions and of Doppler factors, and all that together directly with the dynamical model. So there's a way to both test the model and refine it based on the observation. So in AGNs, we probably resolve the acceleration region. I'm fascinated by what I hear about microcrystals. I don't know if we can do that there to resolve those acceleration regions.
That's right, there was a pause before the applause. No, you weren't sure what
I haven't finished.
Could you, in terms of the extended acceleration region, accelerating just in passing scales, so could you say just a few words about how you can actually maintain the connection well outside the classical fast point?
How I can maintain what, sorry?
I mean, you discussed this issue of if you,
how do you get extended acceleration beyond
what is this modified
path?
What is the modified
path? Okay, so when, what's
the basic?
We had some tutorial here from Bogovalov one afternoon, so it's a nice story, and I refer you to some of his papers, for example, Bogovalov 97, I think, 94, we discussed this. But in one word, you can say, just formally, you can say, suppose I just had this shape of the field line given, then what would be the relevant equation that I solve? I solve the Bernoulli equation along the flow, and that has three critical points, slow, and fast, and these are the relevant critical points. But now, and you can somehow think that the causality, so I'm looking for what regions can influence the source, and here in a way you are already forcing or seeing you're forcing the geometry, so that the geometry is not that hard. But in reality, those things have to be solved together. You have to solve the transfield equation and the acceleration. The acceleration depends on how the shape changes, and of course, once the acceleration goes in, it gives inertia, which makes the changing the shape more difficult. So there are a couple. There are a couple of equations. And so when you look at this system now together and you ask yourself formally, what is now the causality surface from which I can transfer signals back? When I solve those combined systems, you have to distinguish between a causality surface and a surface where the equations change character, say, going from elliptical to hyperbolic. So In the usual spherical case, those things go together. You became hyperbolic, that's the singular point, that's the point where you also the causality surface, and that's... But in this general case, it's not. You're already in the hyperbolic regime. You already made the crossing to the hyperbolic regime. but still you can communicate, you can still influence the origin, and going around the field line, so to speak. You can still influence, you are not confined to going along. But this is just tempering. I mean, formally you can show the causality surface, and it's general, it's not tied to self-similarity or... The self-similarity, as I appreciate from Dalton to Bogovarov, is nice because it turns the equations into ODEs, and then you can show. But there's nothing fundamental to that. The idea that when you have coupled partial differential equations, that their causality surface would not be the same point in general where you change from elliptical to hyperbolic is quite general. And so the causality surface of such hyperbolic partial differential for such partial differential equations that you couple would be quite relevant, and that's what. And this is not purely a heuristic effect. This is also true in non-Newtonian, but it's much easier practically to find, to see the effect of heuristically, because in Newtonian case, you say you accelerated from 0.7 V infinity to 0.9 V infinity, whereas here you accelerate from gamma of 10 to gamma of 1,000. So it makes a big difference. So again, I urge you to look at the Bogovarov and also Tsinganos and Nahakis. Topolos, all of the review articles on this point.
All of which say it very mathematically.
Yeah.
My limited understanding of this boils down to saying that the classical fast point that you described has built into it an assumption that your signals are propagated along the known poloidal field. Once you have the general structure, the signals are not forced to do that. And to some degree, you can get around the corner and have regions over here on a given poloidal flux surface influenced by people that are over here.
That's what I was waving my hand, but yes.
That's the best I understand it. And it's kind of hiding in one of Sergei's papers if you look at the characteristics he draws.
Yeah.
But he doesn't say it in words like that, but if you sort of think about what the characteristics that he calculates are doing, it's kind of like that.
It's amazing that the physics pushes the acceleration region out by.
Well, I'm quite surprised. I've always been surprised, and I don't think I certainly don't personally don't fully understand it, that the separation between this causality surface and the classical fast point could be so large in relativistic flows. It's not true in non-relativistic flows. Some things are quite close together.
So this was already noticed in by Lee, Chui, and Biggerman when they did the cold solution. They didn't appreciate it in this time, so they just coined the term. They called it magnetic nozzle. So it sounds good, but still, I think if you wanted to say more formally, that basically is the difference between the modified or limiting characteristics as distinct or not, and the purely Bernoulli-based critical forms.
This whole subject needs an evolutionary calculation. It may be a lot more convincing in the end.
And those things have started already, right? I know that. But not very satisfactory, I know. I've seen a paper that is not very satisfactory in the Newtonian case, and I've been discussing with myself to do it exactly for the other test.
It's a bit hard because the fast point, even the pretty ordinary fast point, likes to jump right off the grid of anything you try to do, never mind getting to this area.
If you stay away from radio, then you
this is just talking about making a solution, for example, the outflow from a rotating dipole. It's real hard to keep the fast points, you know, where this issue shows up, obviously.
That's right.
And are you doing an evolutionary calculation?
Yeah, this is doing time-dependent, ideal, in this case, relativistic MHD. It's just hard to keep, you know, it's hard to...
So usually the critical points are better behaved.
It's not a question of the critical behaved, it's the separation scales get large. Oh, it takes a big grid, and so it becomes computationally a formidable task.
See, you know, when people... one thing that our community was, I think, victimized by was the fact that we always show monopoles, so which is very silly thing. So when you get away from one point, it comes closer, but as John says, it's still far. It comes closer. So
there's an interesting calculation that Beskin just posted Monday or the end of last week, doing this kind of calculation in the paraboloidal structure. But instead of doing it by similarity, he takes finite density perturbations around, finite sigma, if you like, perturbations around force free. And he has a similar sort of conclusion, although it's a more global calculation. That is, you can accelerate all the way up till sigma gets down to one.
Mm-hmm. Which, based on what we're getting from the self-similarity, which would seem reasonable. I know he's only got right in with it yet, so I'm going to.
Okay, why don't we call it a break? Thank you again, Andrew.